The Bible teaches a very inconvenient truth. You might not want to hear it, but it does teach that human beings are pretty wretched creatures. And sometimes it takes something shocking to make us realize that for ourselves. The fact is, I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason cannot teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the more unlikely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain the origins of life. The amazing thing that quantum physics shows is that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and belief in ways that biblical faith never does. Hey, Cliff Goldstein here. Welcome back to the program. Irene Nemirovsky, or Nemirovsky, however you pronounce it, was a Russian-Jewish immigre who lived in Paris. She had been quite a successful writer, but, well, because she was a Jew, the Nazis deported her to Auschwitz in 1942, where she died. She was 39 years old. Now, her daughter kept many of her mother's possessions, which included a bunch of manuscripts. And it wasn't until some 50 years later was one of the manuscripts uncovered and seen for what it was. It was an unfinished novel. Well, in 2004, that novel was published as Sweet Française, and it became an international bestseller. Though fiction, it was a firsthand account of the Nazi occupation of Paris. It really is a fascinating read. It's a book about human character. It's good side and it's bad, but mostly it's bad. Now, there's one scene in this in which a 17-year-old boy fleeing Paris with his family starts to rail against what he sees as the wretchedness of human nature. It reads as follows. He had been such a good little boy. He had seen the world as simple and beautiful. Man is worthy of respect. Men, a herd of cowards, cowardly wild animals. That René who had urged him to run off and fight the Nazis and then stay tucked under his quilt while France was dying. Those people who refused to give refugees a bed, a glass of water, who charged a fortune for an egg, who stuffed their cars full of luggage, packages, food, even furniture, but who told the women dying of exhaustion and children who had walked from Paris, quote, you can't come with us. You can see very well there's no room, close quote. Think about it, too. What a commentary on human nature. A woman writing about the wretchedness of human nature who was soon to be taken away and murdered only because of who her parents were? I mean, come on. Yes, human nature. You know, folks, you know, I don't want to sound overly pessimistic, but come on, there is something fundamentally wrong with humanity, isn't there? I mean, we are all warped. Sure, some are more warped than others, but we're all still warped. I mean, spoiled milk is spoiled milk. It doesn't have to have green fungus growing on it before you call it soiled, spoiled. I mean, look at the news. Look at history. Look at the lives of people you read about. Look at the lives of people you know. Most of them are messed up, right? Some more than others, yeah, but still messed up all the same. Or forget about the celebs you read about, or your friends or your acquaintances. We all know how messed up they are. What about your own life? Some ways it's kind of a mess, isn't it? See, you know, I don't know most of you who are watching this. I don't know who you are right now. How could I? Maybe few of you. But I don't have to know you. But I'm willing to bet you got a lot of problems. You got a lot of stress. You got a lot of strains. I'd bet that you've all got some messed up relationships that you're probably either filled with anger at someone or rage or guilt or resentment, you know, on and on. I bet you all have, you're probably struggling with impulses and desires and habits that you can't control. You're probably, some of you are struggling with a sense of meaninglessness. Some of you are probably depressed, and to some degree, you probably got a sense of inferiorities. You probably, too, and I'm willing to bet this, and I know it's true, don't try to hide it. You probably have some secrets that you'd rather die than let others find about, huh? And you've probably done some pretty rotten things in your days, and I imagine you've thought some pretty rotten thoughts, too. And I don't even want to depress you by making you think about just how selfish you really are and how envious and jealous of other people you can be. Oh, you know, you can lie and you can shake your head and you can shake your fist at the TV and think I'm full of it. But come on, deep down, you know I'm describing you to some degree, right? Right? Come on. Anyway, you might fool others. You might even fool yourself for a while. But sooner or later, you'll be forced to confront your own personal wretchedness, your own personal demons. Which leads into a short story that I want to talk about today. It was written by the American writer John Cheever, you know, another totally wretched human being who, though achieving quite a bit of fame, lived from what appeared to be a pretty unhappy and unfilled existence. I know because I recently read a biography of John Cheever, and despite all his success and so on, his life was a total disaster. As most of these writers are, in fact. You know, I've read biography of artists and writers and so on, and they all pretty much have a miserable time of it. You know, it's like you could say, well, you can blame it on their profession, on what being a writer and does to you and so on. And I guess it's true to some degree. You know, it's funny. I just recently finished a new biography of James Joyce, another pretty wretched human living a pretty wretched life. And in it, give you an example, he had encouraged the mother of his children. They didn't marry till they had been together for decades. He encouraged her to cheat on him so he could have something to write about. I mean, come on. Not exactly a formula for a happy home. And if your home life is wretched, you could be pretty sure much all else is going to follow suit. That's almost as certain as the second law of thermodynamics. You know, as I said, when we look about these lives, these messed up lives of these writers and artists, we want to blame it on the fact that they're writers and artists and that those professions tend to lead to those kind of lives. And I guess there's some truth to it. But the fact is, you could just be a typical and average snook and still face the same thing. And this is exactly what we have in John Cheever's short story called The Enormous Radio. It's just a typical couple living in New York in a New York City apartment building in the decades following the end of World War II. And that's his story, The Enormous Radio. And that's what I want to talk about because it says something important. It starts out like this. Listen, Jim and Irene Westcott were the kind of people who seemed to strike that satisfactory average of income, endeavor, and respectability that is reached by statistical reports in college alumni bulletins. They were the parents of two young children. They had been married 9 years. They lived on the 12th floor of an apartment house near Sutton Place. They went to the theater on an average of 10.3 times a year, and they hoped to someday live in Westchester. Close quote. Did you catch that one clause? They went to the theater 10.3 times a year, okay? That was, I think, John Cheever's rather brilliant way of trying to show just how normal or average a couple they were. Well, anyway, in the story, they one day go out and buy a fancy new radio, one of those great big old ones, the size of one of those big fat computer monitors from 10 years ago. You have to go to a museum today to see those radios in real life. You got to remember here, we're talking now about the 1950s. Anyway, they get this enormous radio, and the wife is the one who listens to it most of the time. Then one day, they discover something astonishing. The radio picks up conversations all through their apartment building. Yeah, suddenly they're able to listen in on the private lives of others in their complex. Some of the people they know, some of them are strangers, But soon their words are now coming through Jim and Irene's enormous radio. The story continues. Here they're talking. "This must be the Fullers in 11E, Irene said. "I knew they were giving a party this afternoon. I saw her in the liquor store. Isn't this too divine? Try something else. See if we can get those people in 18C. Okay, then he goes on and explains more. "The Westcotts overheard that evening a monologue on salmon fishing in Canada, a bridge game, running comments on whole movies of what had apparently been a fortnight at Sea Island, and a bitter family quarrel about an overdraft at a bank. They turned off their radio at midnight and went to bed, weak with laughter. Sometime in the night, their son began to call for a glass of water, and Irene got and took one to his room. It was very early. All the lights in the neighborhood were extinguished, and from the boy's window, she could see the empty street. She went into the living room and tried the radio. There was some faint coughing, a moan, and then a man spoke. 'Are you all right, darling?' he asked. 'Yes,' a woman said wearily. 'Yes, I'm all right, I guess.' And then she added with great feeling, 'But you know, Charlie, I don't feel like myself anymore. Sometimes there are about 15 or 20 minutes in a week when I feel like myself. I don't feel like going to another doctor because the doctor's bills are so awful already. But I just don't feel like myself, Charlie. I never just feel like myself.'" They were not young, Irene thought. She guessed from the timbre of their voices that they were middle-aged. The restrained melancholy of the dialogue and drafts from the bedroom window made her shiver, and she went back to bed, close quote. Soon in the story, Irene is spending a lot of time listening to the radio, listening to what is going on in the private lives of her neighbors. And at times, too, she would see people in the elevator, and she would wonder if those were the ones whose private lives and inner secrets she was overhearing. The story continues. Quote, "She overheard demonstrations of indigestion, carnal love, abysmal vanity, faith, and despair. Irene's life was nearly as simple and sheltered as it appeared to be, and forthright and sometimes brutal language that came from the loudspeaker that morning astonished and troubles her. She continued to listen until her maid came in. Then she turned off the radio quickly, since this insight, she realized, was a furtive one." Close quote. Yes, day after day, usually after a few drinks, while the kids were in school and Jim was working, Irene would sit in her living room and listen to the enormous radio. Cheever continues. As the afternoon waned, the conversations increased in intensity. From where Irene sat, she could see the open sky above the East River. There were hundreds of clouds in the sky, as though the south wind had broken the winter into pieces and were blowing it north. And on her radio, she could hear the arrival of cocktail guests and the return of children and businessmen from their schools and offices. "I found a good-sized diamond ring on the bathroom floor this morning," a woman said. "It must have fallen out of the bracelet of Mrs. Dunson was wearing last night." "We'll sell it," a man said. "Take it down to the jeweler on Madison Avenue and sell it. Mrs. Dunson won't know the difference, and we can use a couple hundred bucks." Close quote. This is going on and on. Things, though, come to a head when one night her husband comes home from work. And what happens? Cheever writes, "Emma, the maid, let him in. And as he'd taken off his hat and was taking off his coat, when Irene ran into the hall, her face was shining with tears and her hair was disordered. 'Go up to room 16C, Jim,' she screamed. 'Don't take off your coat. Go up to 16C. Mr. Osborne's beating his wife. They've been quarreling since 4 o'clock, and now he's hitting her. Go up and stop them.'" Okay, this is what she says to him. Okay, what happens? Cheever continues. From the radio in the living room, Jim heard screams, obscenities, and thuds. You know, you don't have to listen to the sort of thing, he said. He strode into the living room and turned the switch. It's indecent, he said. It's like looking in the windows. You know, you don't have to listen to this thing. You could turn it off. Oh, it's so terrible. It's so dreadful, Irene was sobbing. I've been listening all day, and it's so depressing. Well, if it's depressing, why do you listen to it? I brought this radio to give you some pleasure, he said. I paid a great deal of money for it. I thought it might make you happy. I wanted to make you happy. Anyway, it goes on, and they start the fight. And then she says to him, she pleads with him, don't quarrel with me, she moaned, and laid her head on his shoulder. All others have been quarreling all day. Everybody's been quarreling. They're all worried about money. Mrs. Hutchinson's mother is dying of cancer in Florida, and they don't have enough money to send her to the Mayo Clinic. At least Mr. Hutchinson says they don't have enough money. And some woman in this building is having an affair with the handyman, with that hideous handyman. It's too disgusting. And Mr. Melville has heart trouble. And Mr. Hendricks is going to lose his job in April. And Mrs. Hendricks is horrid about the whole thing. And that girl plays the Missouri Waltz. Missouri Waltz is a whore, a common whore. And the elevator man has tuberculosis. And Mr. Osborne has been beating his wife. She wailed. She trembled with grief and checked a stream of tears down her face with the heel of her palm. And the husband's trying to calm her down, trying to make some sense of this. And he says to her, why do you have to listen? Jim asks again. Why do you have to listen to the stuff if it makes you miserable? Oh, don't, she cried. Life is too terrible, too sordid and awful. But we've never been like that. Have we, darling? Have we? I mean, we've always been good and decent and loving to one another, haven't we? And we have two children, two beautiful children. Our lives aren't sordid, are they, darling? She flung her arms around his neck and drew his face down to hers. We're happy, aren't we, darling? We're happy, aren't we? Close quote. Funny that she has to ask this. He comes back to her. Of course we're happy, he said tiredly. He began to surrender his resentment. Of course we're happy. I'll have that radio fixed or taken away tomorrow. He stroked her hair. My poor girl, he said. Then she continues on. She says to him, you love me, don't you? She asked. And we're not hypocritical or worried about money or dishonestly, are we? Or dishonesty, are we? Anyway, the radio gets fixed the next morning. And Irene kept it on all day. And John Cheever writes, and nothing untoward came from the speaker. Now, what happens next in the story is very, very interesting. And in some ways, it's really the point of John Cheever's story. Jim Westcott comes home, and he and Irene start arguing about money. They start arguing about how much Irene is spending. It gets quite hot, just like some of the conversations that they used to overhear on the enormous radio. Now, I want you to listen carefully. I want you to listen to how John Cheever ends this story. You know everything that came before. They heard everything that was going on, and it was getting her all upset, and they're saying, we're not like that, we're not like that. And finally, he said, it's too much, so they're going to get rid of the radio. And they get rid of the radio. It's no longer a factor. Anyway, here's how he ends the story. We've got to start cutting down, Jim said. We've got to think of the children. To be perfectly frank with you, I worry about money a great deal. I'm not at all sure of the future. No one is. If anything should happen to me, there's the insurance, but that won't go very far today. I've worked awfully hard to give you and the children a comfortable life, he said bitterly. I don't like to see all my energies, all my youth, wasted in fur coats and radios and slip covers. And please, Jim, she said, please, they'll hear us. Who will hear us? Emma can't hear us. The radio, she said. Oh, I'm sick, he shouted. I'm sick to death of your apprehensiveness. The radio can't hear us. Nobody can hear us. And if they can hear us, who cares? Irene got up from the table and went into the living room. Jim went to the door and shouted from there, "Why are you so Christly all of a sudden? What's turned you overnight into a convent girl? You stole your mother's jewelry before they probated her will. You never gave your sister a cent of that money that was intended for her, not even when she needed it. You made Grace Howland's life miserable. And where was all your piety and virtue when you went to the abortionist? I'll never forget how cold you were. You packed your bag and went off to have that child murdered as if you were going to Nassau. If you had any reasons, if you had any good reasons," stay stops. Irene stood a moment before the hideous cabinet, disgraced and sickened, but she held her hand on the switch before she extinguished the music and the voices, hoping the instrument might speak kindly to her, that she might hear the Sweeney's nurse. That was one of the people that they had heard. Jim continued to shout at her from the door. The voice on the radio was suave and noncommittal. And the voice says, "An early morning railroad disaster in Tokyo," the loudspeaker said, "killed 29 people. A fire in a Catholic hospital near Buffalo for the care of blind children was extinguished early this morning by the nuns. The temperature is 47. The humidity is 89. Close quote. Thus ends John Cheever's The Enormous Radio. Did you see what happened in the story? And if you can't pick it up from the show, download the story from the internet. You can read it. You get it. It's powerful. But did you see what happened there? She's listening in on all these miserable, wretched situations, the whole time thinking that her and her family are just fine. Somehow they're not like the others. But guess what? They are. Their fight revealed them to be just like the others. Messed up, dysfunctional, hypocritical, and so forth. All that she thought they weren't, they were. It was as if the radio came into their house and forced them away from their illusion of innocence. I read somewhere where someone said this is almost like a story of Eden and the fall from innocence in Eden. She wanted to believe that they were different. She wanted to believe that they were better. To repeat what she said earlier, I mean, we've always been good and decent and loving to one another, haven't we? And we have two children, two beautiful children. Our lives aren't sordid. Are they, darling? Are they? She flung her arms around his neck and drew her face down to his. We're happy, darling, right? We're happy, aren't we? I mean, folks, to have to ask if you're happy pretty much says that you're not happy, doesn't it? And these were just, again, these are just your normal average people. We're the kind that go to the theater 10.3 times a year. We're not talking about these famous megastars, these messed up movie stars and artists and so on. We're just talking about plain old average Joe, like most of us are. Yes, however depressing, and it was depressing, Cheever's story brings out the hypocrisy and wretchedness of this couple, which I would suggest probably aren't a whole lot different from any of us. Sure, we might have it differently and might manifest it differently, but it's all there. I mean, hey, think about it for a minute. How would you feel if someone could listen in on your life, could see you do the things you do when you think no one is looking? Or tell about a really scary thought. What about the thoughts that you think? How would you like someone to be able to get in and think the thoughts that you think? What are the things that you secretly desire that you would not want to let anyone know? I mean, come on, folks. I'm not pointing anyone in particular. I'm pointing to us all. We're all messed up, all of us. That's what the Bible says. And so this idea of inherent human sinfulness is really not a teaching you need a whole lot of faith for, is it? Hey, folks, just look in the mirror. We can see how messed up we all are. And the amazing thing about this story was how it just brings it out. It brought it out in a very unique way. The wretchedness of this couple, who on the surface seems so nice and fine and not a whole lot different from the rest of us. But you know, the amazing thing is too that despite this, despite how hypocritical, judgmental, greedy, and selfish we are, you know what? God loves us. That, I think, is one of the perhaps the most amazing thing of the plan of salvation. It was for all humanity, this whole, to quote Nemirovsky, herd of wild, cowardly animals, which is us as human beings. No question, you who are listening to me, hey, I don't have to know who you are. I know to some degree you are messed up. I don't even have to know you to know that you are messed up. If you are a human being, a Homo sapien, you are messed up. And you know, you're probably worse than you think, because most of us live under a veil of self-delusion. We could probably be glad that we are, because I think most of us would lose it if we really got a glimpse of just how bad you were. If you really knew how bad you were, I don't think you could handle it. You know, here's the amazing thing. God knows how messed up you are. He knows better than you know. And again, as I said, the amazing thing is He loves you anyway, no matter how messed up you were. The good news is that Jesus wasn't messed up. Jesus lived a perfect life. And Jesus died for you precisely because you're so messed up. So messed up that only the death of Jesus could atone for your sins. Jesus came and lived the perfect life that you don't live, that you can't live, that you've never lived. Jesus came to cover you and to cover your messed up life, because you have messed it up royally. And that's the great plan of salvation. But no matter how wretched we are, no matter how much we might be more like the Westcotts than we realize, hey, I'm not saying it doesn't matter. It matters, and it's bad. But the good news is Jesus died for you. You're a wretch. Let's face it. I'm a wretch. Okay? I don't know anybody to some degree probably doesn't have some wretchedness in them. But hey, the good news, Christ died for wretches just like you and just like me. Now, the question is, what are you going to do about it?